Welcome to the Adventure Audio Podcast. This is episode 160. It's a crazy number to hear me say out loud. In this episode, Laval and I are hosting Andrew Reed, who's a fitness trainer from Melbourne, Australia. That's R-E-A-D. And he's one of my absolute favorite follows on Instagram recently. And I know that definitely is the truth for Laval as well. This is a really, really fun interview. Andrew's a very awesome and inspirational guy. So thank you again, Andrew, for making the time to do this. He's going to be off on some mountaineering adventures soon. So we'll hope to circle back with Andrew and interview him again and talk about some of those more specifics. So very fun episode. We're going to drop you one last clue here. So we're doing a giveaway for two power meters from 4i Technologies, as well as two heart rate monitors. This is the last episode that we're doing that. So we've done this for four episodes in total. So if you want to go backwards to the past three episodes, and you can send us an email to adventureaudiopodcast@gmail.com or send us a message on our Instagram account. So the way to find us is Adventure Audio, and give us the answer to this question. So where was Andrew born? He does mention that in this episode. So shoot us a note, tell us where Andrew was born, and you'll be entered to win. And if you haven't entered from the previous three episodes, go back, give us a listen, and send us the answer to those. You'll be entered every time that you submit an entry per episode. So increase your chances to win, and then we'll do the giveaway shortly after publishing this episode. So you can stay tuned for that too. Very excited to give that away. So thank you, 4i, for your support. We really appreciate it. And on to this episode of the podcast. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in.
But I want to start off with a quote. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Adventure Audio Podcast. We have Andrew Reed joining us all the way from Victoria State in Melbourne, Australia, a beautiful city that I almost froze my ass off in once. But I'm going to start off, and I posted this yesterday about Andrew, one of his Instagram posts, and this is a quote from an Instagram video, and this is what got me interested in Andrew's story. And I actually sent this to Pete a few months ago, just randomly. I stumbled upon this crazy Aussie trainer and decided that I want to start following him. So here's the quote, and this will sort of lay out what why I was hooked by Andrew's message. "You are only as good as the guy you are right now today. Go take your shirt off, go look in the mirror, take a photo of it to see how you really look, the guy you are today, and start working on making that guy better." Now, it was full of profanity with a perfect Aussie accent, but I think that best encapsulates who Andrew is. So welcome to the podcast, Andrew.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, I will say, for an Australian, there was actually surprisingly a little swearing in it.
Well, you are permitted to swear on this podcast, so feel free to release at will, no problem at all. So, Andrew, when we do the introduction or podcast, we're going to introduce our listeners to who you are. But how did you get started? And I mean, where did you grow up? What got you into the physical training space? And what got you into now what appears to be a new love of mountaineering? Take it away.
Wow, that's a long story. So I grew up everywhere, literally. My father worked for Mobil and was quite good at his job. So let's see, I was born in Fiji. We moved to Melbourne, Adelaide, Ethiopia, Connecticut in the States, then back to Queensland, then back to Melbourne. I went to school in Switzerland for tertiary education, came back to Melbourne. My parents returned from Brazil. And so Melbourne's kind of home. But, you know, I went to, I think it was like a dozen schools by the time I was in grade six. And one of the things about always being a new kid is that you're always on the outside, but the language that speaks to everyone is sport. So if you can, I don't know, kick a ball well, hit a ball well, run fast, something, then suddenly you've gotten in with other kids. And so that was probably my in. And then at some point when we were here, my mother realized what a unruly, disruptive child I was, and thought some martial arts would be good for me. Enrolled me in Taekwondo at 10, and I was a little bit intimidated by it. It all looked very serious and hard work. And the guy who was my instructor has ended up being, he was the Australian Olympic coach for quite a few years. So
in the early years of Olympic Taekwondo, all of the Australians who medaled were his students. And so I trained quite seriously there. I missed the 1988 Olympics by one spot when I was in year 11 at school. So by the time I'd finished school, I already knew about hard training. I mean, I was probably training like 12 to 15 hours a week as a 16, 17-year-old kid to try to make the Olympics. Went to hotel school overseas, did my best to stay in shape while I was away. It was very difficult because the food in Switzerland as a student was not great. And then came home, and I guess that's where it started getting really serious. I joined the Commando Reserves, so I was training again like sort of 20 hours a week to do that. And then over time, you know, I got to about 38. And we'll just say I was doing like standard fitness plus martial arts stuff up until about then. But I got to 38 and I was writing for a few magazines and I started thinking, well, hang on, I'm nearly 40. Surely something changes at 40. So I should probably have a look around at what's being said for 40-year-olds. And I realized there wasn't anything. And so I started working specifically on this, like, what do you do as a 40-year-old subject? And the easiest way to figure it out was to be a crash test dummy. And so I did like a 1,000-kilometer bike ride. It was a charity thing. So we rode from Canberra to Melbourne. I don't want to exaggerate. It was 970 kilometers. I did an Ironman like a year after that. I think 2 years after that, I did this thing called SEAL Fit, which is like a 3-day no sleep civilian version of Hell Week that the SEALs run as the culmination of phase one of BUDS. And it's run by Navy SEALs. So that was pretty tough. I mean, they really just kicked the snot out of you for 3 days. And over time, I've just been looking for ways to challenge myself more and more and more. And obviously, speed and power goes like this, and injuries get in the way. There's no way I can go back to trying to compete in Olympic level Taekwondo, for instance, but I can still walk up a hill. And so that's where the interest in mountaineering came from. I basically see a triathlon. I see a strength and conditioning problem that has to be solved at altitude and has some technical climbing skills to go with it. And as a beginner, it's quite an exciting problem to try to solve from a strength and conditioning perspective. So, you know, it combines all of the elements from the fitness side as well as all the mental side of things involved with, you know, being able to ride 1,000 kilometers or not necessarily gut out an Ironman, because I think Ironman, the day is actually pretty easy. The training before it is very difficult. And even down to mindset things, because when you realize that the mindset that is involved with forcing yourself out the door to do a training session you don't want to do, it's actually the same skill as not eating some crap food because you're trying to lose weight. So combining all of those elements together now into a single thing is pretty interesting to me.
That's a great introduction. Well put. It's almost like you've done that before. I've been really into getting a kick in the ass, like from various places, right? So ever since Laval sent me that first message or note on Instagram, one of your videos, I've been pretty into your Instagram videos for the last couple of months, because not only is it the slap in the face that I need to get moving sometimes, but it's also like demographically, I'm 44 this year. It's starting to resonate more and more with me. So like, when you started to lean into the 40-year-old sort of demographic and helping people with that, was it immediately clear to you that you'd found a particular niche?
Yeah, I mean, and accidentally. And I actually did the same. So when I was figuring out how to make my own training business successful, you know, there's obviously a lot of sort of different areas you can delve into, but a quick Google search shows you actually that running is one of the most Googled fitness terms possible. It's like, well, hang on, there's this book called Born to Run that's come out and it's selling millions of copies. And in the community that I was involved in, which was this kettlebell community run by a guy called Pavel Satsulin, there would always be questions on the forum about running and no one knew how to answer them because no one actually had any background in running. There'd be guys saying, oh, you know, the best way to train for a marathon is just do repeat 100-meter sprints. And I don't know if they've ever watched any of the Kipchoge training videos or Gebrselassie or anything like that, but that's clearly not the best way to train for these things. And so I started looking for the best ways to do it. I wrote a book about running, but that was all from a deliberate desire to have a side of my business that no one else was really interested in, or seemingly not interested in. Because in the running community, there's basically runners who don't really understand strength training. And in the strength training community, there's strength trainers who don't really understand running. There's not many people who could do both. In the 40-year-old community, it was by accident, because when I looked around, and there are some guys who actually still have more experience than me. There's not many trainers around who've got more years in the game than I do, but they're really just focused on in the gym. And to me, while the gym is an important part of things, it's only an accessory. The gym is only there to assist us having the best life possible. And so actually, when I started looking into it, the biggest problem I found was no one was actually doing it. And there are a number of people you can find with huge followings online who are muscular and lean in my age group, I'll say our age group, but all they're doing is standing in the gym. And that's fine for some people, but I know there's a lot of people out there who want to have a more adventurous life than that, that they don't want to spend their peak years left. Because obviously physically we're running out of time, right? Like there's definitely a clock ticking in terms of your ability to go and have really epic adventures.
100% there is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and we talked about mountaineering, like, you know, this interest my wife and I have, we've obviously looked at 8,000 meters as well. And when you look at the risk, so the risk of death is 1%, and it's stable up until 50 years old, and doesn't matter the mountain, it's about a 1% risk of death above 8,000 meters. And then all of a sudden, at 60, it goes to 25%. And at 70, it's 75%. So you hit mid-50s and it skyrockets. I'm 52. Like, if we want to do this thing, so like our climbing plans are very ambitious, because they have to be, because I'm the problem. I'm running out of time. If we want to do one of these things, we've got probably two years, I would think, before the risk becomes so high it's not worth me doing anymore. So the chasing the 40-year-old thing was because I recognize that no one else is actually doing these things. And when I look around in the fitness industry, I see a lot of lean guys. I see a lot of strong guys in their 40s. There's some questionable testosterone use, I think, like guys well beyond TRT, but there's not any or many that I can find who are actually out proving that what they're saying for fitness is actually backed up with real world results. There's a few guys like Cam Haynes and David Goggins still who are clearly showing what's possible. There, I think Cam Haynes is 3 years older than me. David Goggins is the same age. So there are guys there doing it, but there are so few of them who are actually showing that you don't have to just stand in the gym.
Yeah. Cam Haynes is a beast and a huge
amazing
for
yeah.
gym work, right? But a lot yeah. of cardio, lots of cardio.
Tons. Yeah. And that, you know, but when you, he has those posts where he's like, yeah, I woke up and I ran 20 miles this morning, ran nearly a marathon before breakfast. Just as a Wednesday or something. That's incredible.
It is. It's unbelievable the pace that he's been able to keep up for years, right? Like, I've been following Cam Haynes for, I don't even know, at least a decade, and he was very experienced then. It's crazy.
Well, and that's the other problem is, you know, like, when people, you know, they'll say, well, okay, I'm the same age as Cam Haynes. Yeah, but he was a great high school runner. He was a good level collegiate sort of runner. Like, you know, like, he's always been a good runner. He's never stopped running apart from, you know, that period he talks about early in his life where he was kind of a bit of a dropout and just drinking and not doing much. But he's always had the skill, very different to me, who's never been a good runner. So in high school, I was a good swimmer. I was a pretty crappy runner though. So for me to develop good running skill now, almost impossible. And people make that mistake of thinking that, well, we're the same age, why can't I do that? Well, the answer is because, you know, he's got a lifetime of ability at it and you don't.
Yeah. Clearly a talented runner. Yeah, for sure. But it's such a cool example of, like you mentioned, Born to Run. I think the statistic that stuck out to me most when I read that book was that when we draw a line of our athletic peak, it actually starts at 18 years old, but it doesn't end until 63. That's the peak. right?
For running, yeah.
For running from a cardiovascular an endurance standpoint. So we have a huge, huge long sweet spot, and I think that's largely taken for granted.
Yeah, I trained a woman named Lynn Spencer. So she came seventh at one Olympics for cross-country skiing. So she went to multiple Olympics. She amazing, clearly. Lived this amazing life growing up in Alaska, where she said she didn't even see a rotary phone until she was like 13 or 14 years old. They lived in a homestead, hunted all their own food. She still hunts at least half of what she eats now, and she's in her 70s. She's a part-time field biologist studying different parts of the ecosystem in Alaska. So it goes out on hunts and multi-day expeditions and stuff, collecting data now. In her 70s, her VO2 is still in the 50s.
Wow.
It just shows you what's possible as long as you stay active, right?
But I guess one thing on that note, it's a perfect segue into, you're talking about not wanting to go high in your mountaineering, your new love of high altitude climbing. But I think when you look at the stats, over 60, I think you said, is a 25% chance of getting the chop. You're looking at somebody who hasn't had a lifetime of physical training like you've had, Andrew. And plus, I mean, this has been your job literally for two and a half decades.
Three, as of this year, actually. But
there saying you go. That,
Conrad Anker had a heart attack at 6,500 meters. So,
That's true.
And actually, when we went on our last trip, so that post you're talking about on Instagram, I filmed that in the middle of the Himalayas. I think we're at Zonguldak. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, I saw it.
We met him at the Yak and Yeti at breakfast one morning, and he actually just happened to like stop the conversation suddenly, look me in the eye and say, make sure you take a baby aspirin every day. Guys in our age group have a risk of heart attack here as the altitude gets higher. And I did exactly what he said. If we were having a day where we went over 5,000 meters, I made sure I had a baby aspirin in the morning. So, you never know with those things, right? There's a genetic component. Yeah. And there's just a roll of the dice. So, I mean, for me, when you choose a hobby, and like a physical hobby, that hobby should enhance your life. It shouldn't make it worse. So I stopped martial arts because I was just starting to get beaten up. It was no longer giving back to me the amount of effort I was putting in. It was only taking from me. It wasn't giving me anything anymore. And the moment when climbing a mountain, or a big mountain, we'll say, presents so much of a risk that, and 25% chance is fairly high as an example, whereas I could go to New Zealand and climb a 3,000 meter mountain at 60 years old and be fine. So, mm-hmm. It's not about stopping it, but it's about picking an activity that's actually suitable for where you're at in life. And that's what that post was really about, was stop picking with your ego, stop picking with the idea of who you used to be, and start making rational decisions about where you're at today. That doesn't mean don't enjoy yourself, don't push yourself, but it means make a smart choice, like an actual informed choice about where you're at, rather than one based on ego.
Or just hope. Or just blind hope.
Hope is a terrible strategy.
100%. I mean, what's that saying from that Greek philosopher Archilochus? He says that, and I don't think he said this exact part, but he said, when the shit hits the fan, we don't fall back on our hopes, prayers, and dreams. We fall back on our level of preparation. Right.
Yeah exactly.
I think that's, yeah. I mean, sums it up, especially when you're going high.
Yeah. That's, I mean, what I've trained special forces guys, so you look at things and there'll be a run test and there'll be a ruck test, and you know what I mean, like just the standard kind of physical tests you would expect to see, and you need to be able to do them at your worst. You know, if I use Buds as an example, it's a 4-mile beach run in boots and pants. You get 32 minutes at the start. That standard comes down to 28 minutes at the end. But you need to be able to hit a sub 32 on your worst day, when you've had no sleep, when you might not have eaten, when you might have just had to do 400 push-ups for punishment or something. So if you can't hit that with ample room to spare on your worst day, you're just not ready for that course. And mm-hmm. the same level of preparation should apply to, like, if you can't go out and climb 1,000 vertical meters with your heart rate somewhere in the 140 to 160 range for however many hours that takes, you're just not ready.
Mm-hmm. This Seal Fit, is this the Mark Divine of course yeah. or event that he puts on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, that is bloody hard. That's bloody hard.
It was, look, it is and it isn't. I actually did it twice. I did the first time. I just had a bad day. I didn't unpack my running legs, and we'd done, oh man, like probably like 2 hours of what I'm going to call welcome party at the very start of the day. And people quit during the initial PT part. Then we went out and did a fair bit of, I don't know, like crap on the beach, and the pace running to the beach. Even I remember as we got to the beach, we were running so fast. I was starting to panic a little bit, thinking like, you know, like, I can't hold this pace for too much longer. And then I looked around and realized everyone else was at their limit as well. And we were going to have to back off sooner or later. And, you know, we turned a corner and suddenly stopped. So really easy to talk yourself out of things, but realizing everyone else is in the same boat for me makes that a lot easier. Hours of, you know, like carrying people up and down the sand and sandbag stuff and in and out of the water. And then a bit of a blur. I can't even remember. We did some log PT and some other stuff. And we did, oh, that's right. We'd done the PST by that point when we came back from the beach, and my run time. So it's I've got to remember, I think it's a mile and a half run, and whatever the time cutoff is, I think it's 9:30, which under normal circumstances I could do in my sleep, but I missed it by about 5 seconds. And, you know, people who don't understand will say, oh, you know, you were so close, but the standard's the standard. I missed the standard. And you're allowed to fail 2 things out of the physical standards test, you know, which is like push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, run, and then you do Murph as well. And they have a 75-minute time cutoff. And by that point, when we were about to do Murph at about midnight after starting at 9 a.m., we'd been for what I think was about a 2-hour beach run in quite deep sand, in and out of cold water as well. And I missed Murph by like about 2 minutes, and I was gone. So I came home and licked my wounds for a bit, told myself I didn't really need to go and fuck Seal Fit and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I remember it was the day after Christmas, and we had big sales for Boxing Day around Christmas time. My wife left the house to go and buy something and left me home alone with my credit card, and I signed up again. And I just made sure that the second time I went, there were no problems. You never leave an idiot alone with their credit card. And so the second time,
when you say you came home, did you flew back from California, I'm assuming, all the way back to Australia and was stewing on this and then went back?
It's actually worse than that. So I went to Seal Fit.
this is a great story.
Yeah, yeah. I went to Seal Fit, and then I had to go to the UK to go, I was teaching at a workshop, and then flew back to Australia. I did a half Ironman 2 weeks after I came back to Australia. And this is the stupid thing. So I set a run PR in the half Ironman. So like my fitness was there. It just wasn't there on the day for whatever reason. You know, maybe I wasn't good enough at sand running. Maybe I was a bit jet lagged, like whatever the reason, doesn't matter. It just wasn't there. And I just made sure that when I went back the second time, there were no mistakes. So like Murph, where I was 2 minutes slow, I beat the cutoff time by 15 minutes. The next time, and actually set a 1 minute all time PR for myself when I did it.
Wow.
Yeah. And like the run time for the PST, where I'd missed it barely the time before, I beat it by over a minute the next time. So like I just made sure that there were no gaps this time when I went. And I look at our climbing as the same. So our last trip to Nepal, we were going to climb Lobosher and Island Peak, which are about 6,000 meters. And mm-hmm. I love how the Nepalese call these beginner peaks, and everywhere else in the world, that would be massive. But my wife broke her middle finger on her right hand just before we left, like 5 days before we left. And obviously that makes dewmaring pretty difficult. And mm-hmm. the conditions were also not great because it was September, so it was the edge of monsoon. Wasn't quite cold enough. The snow was really soft and deep. So like really struggling to walk through it. And we're going to go back in April, and this is part of the accelerated program that I talked about. So we're going to go and do Lobosheet or climatize and then go and climb Amour du Blanc. Try to climb Amour du Blanc.
Nice.
But what we recognized, aside from the broken finger, was that one of my wife's drawbacks was not enough leg strength. So she really struggled in the, you know, like the soft snow, because obviously it's much harder work. So her program currently has got way more leg strength stuff in it to overcome that. Like, we're doing days where we just drag a sled around a park for an hour at a time. So it's just about filling the gaps in. I mean, that's all training ever is once you recognize the weakness, you have to address it. And then what you should be doing when you go and compete is that you compete to your strengths. So if you're really good at like a diesel powered kind of ascent where you're just going to slowly trudge your way up, you need to make sure you can do that. If you're someone who needs to go fast and then take a break and then go fast and take a break, then you need to climb that way. Don't get yourself sucked into fighting someone else's fight, basically.
One thing about mountaineering, I think that is so important is that it has to be all round fitness. People think it's just endurance, but you have to think you're carrying heavy loads, you're twisting, you're turning, you're kicking. Obviously, you're struggling at high altitude as well, but you're setting up tents at 7,000 or 8,000 meters, depending on where you're climbing. You're dealing with very high temperatures, very low temperatures. You may have to haul somebody out of a crevasse with all your upper body strength. And I think you owe it to your team and obviously to yourself that you have that all-round fitness, not just the ability to go uphill fast, but the ability to pull your mate out of a crevasse, for example, or climb yourself out of a crevasse. And that's sure. Why I find training for mountaineering to be an all-round type of fitness for sure.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, you know, my involvement with it really started, I don't know, like about 2011 or so. I was a fan of Jim Jones, you know, Mark Twight.
Of course.
He just trained the guys for that 300. In fact, I think he trained the first 300 movie and the second one had just come out. They were maybe doing some stuff with Superman around that time as well, with Henry Cavill. And I went and did their courses. And actually, I did their advanced instructor course the week before I went back to Seal Fit for the second time. We were training twice a day. And if anyone's ever trained using a Jim Jones template, like, the training sessions are pretty hectic. That was my recovery week before I went back to Seal Fit. That shows you the level of training that I was at. And actually, I can remember days where we weren't training enough. And so I was having to run to and from my hotel just to get some extra minutes in for the day. I'd be doing push-ups and pull-ups at lunchtime when everyone else was like having a nap and resting, because we actually, even for my recovery week, I wasn't getting enough volume in.
Jim Jones, his workouts, hectic. That's the understatement of the year.
Yeah, his training style is, I mean, for anyone who's done his workouts, very difficult workouts. And, you know, he's the guy who a lot of people associate with kind of that, like, modern alpinist style of training. And so having been along there, I actually, Rob Shaw from, I think it's Mountain Tactical, he actually came to the RKC, the kettlebell thing that I used to teach. He was on my team as a student for one of the events. So, you know, like, I've had some connection with all these guys for, I mean, that was definitely 2010 that I met him. So there's been quite a bit of influence there from those guys and seeing what's necessary. And I think you're right. You know, you see so many people talking about the best way to climb, just get on the Stairmaster and stay there for hours, you know, go for a run for 2 hours. And okay,
oh,
so your aerobic system is going to be trained, but how are you going to go with 20 kilo on your back? Or like you said, like, okay, so now you've got a Juma for 3 hours. Like, how many one arm rows can you do with essentially body weight before your arm tires out? You're not going to last very long.
Yeah, and if you don't know how to manage yourself either with the drastic temperature changes as well, it's kind of funny. I mean, I've climbed in the Himalayas and sometimes it's 30 degrees Celsius, and then within about 6 hours it could be minus 20 or minus 25 depending on how high you are and what the weather is, and you have to be able to adapt to all of that and know exactly what to wear and how much to drink and how much to eat. And it's the ultimate, I think.
I've climbed in the Himalayas. I mean, way to understate what you've done, because you've done a no O2 ascent of Everest, right?
Yeah, but this podcast is about you, Andrew, so we're not supposed to talk about that.
It's funny, though, because I said exactly that to my mother. So we went to Just before COVID, we were going to go to this place called Kongi, which gives you a really good view of Everest. It's about 4,200 meters. It's isolated. There's only two lodges up there. So it's a really quiet place to stay. They fly helicopters up there so the rich people can have breakfast looking at Everest. And we missed out because of COVID. So we were going to go like a week or two before COVID shut everything down. And my wife and I got married this year in March, and we actually did that trip again as our honeymoon. And
oh, nice.
That was, yeah. And we walked up Kongi Reef. So we walked up to like 4,500 meters. So that was easily the highest thing we'd been up at that point. And the experience was exactly as you said, like just this constant undoing and doing up of zippers, take this layer off, put this one on, change my hat for a beanie, you know, just, it almost felt like every 10 to 15 minutes you're messing around with some part of your clothing, and it was very difficult to get it right. And obviously the higher you go, the harder that's going to be, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. And yeah, you have to really learn how to take good care of your body, or else, I mean, or you could have some pretty grave circumstances for sure.
Well, that's, I mean, interesting. So I, on our last trip, I was fine. I didn't have any stomach troubles. I had, in the mornings, I would get a slight headache, which would go away as soon as I drank some water. On one of the acclimatizing hikes, like over Chola Pass or something like that, I remember getting a slight headache, but went away as soon as we went down a little bit. My wife basically had headaches all the way from Chola, then to Lobosha, up Lobosha. And then because it was clear that her hand was no good and trying to climb Island Peak was going to actually make it much worse and make going back to work more difficult. And because she's a firefighter, she really needs her hands for work. So we decided to bin the idea of climbing Island Peak and would just go to Gorikshed, hike up Kalapatar, and then walk down, and it was going to work out about the same. And she had headaches in Gorikshed and climbing Kalapatar and was really slow. And when we traced it back, she was only drinking about a liter and a half or 2 liters of water a day. And so after we'd been going for about 10 or 12, just started to falling to pieces. And, you know, like from a health perspective, that's one of the things I work on with people is I just need you to drink more water. I mean, the actual stuff I work on from a health perspective with people, it's actually sleep is the number one thing I try to get people to really embrace. Like you need, if you want to be athletic, at least 7 or 8 hours a night, even better, get 9 or 10. And if you can nap on top of that, that's going to be even better. But that's usually not practical for people. And then getting them to actually make sure they've got enough fluid on board, because it just makes everything else, like you'll digest food better, you'll actually be less bloated. There's a whole bunch of great things that come from just drinking enough water. But from an altitude perspective, because you need more fluid for the gas exchange at high altitude than you do at sea level. So even just to breathe, you need more water than you would think you do. And for her, and for women in general, you know, there's a little bit of that hesitancy to need to go to the toilet on the trail because it might be a little bit difficult, or there's a little bit of like embarrassment or something like that. But she managed to find, you know, these things like she-wees and freshets and things like that that allow women to pee standing up without using without needing to take their pants off and squat down. And so that made things a lot better, but we need to go to another level. Like she needs to double the amount of water she's drinking.
Well, yeah, because if you think about the extra hemoglobin that your body's trying to produce, right, to carry that oxygen, your blood is actually thickening up. And one thing that occurs is altitude, and of course you know this, is that your blood pressure can spike, right? We had people backing off of expeditions because of capillaries blowing in their eye, because of hemorrhoids. And that's because of the dramatic increase in blood pressure. And of course, the way you fight that, the increased viscosity of your blood, is by drinking tons of liquids.
I will be sure to pass that on, because, you know, it's one of those things. I don't know if you guys have ever tried to train your partner. It's really difficult, because even though she knows how good I am at my job, getting her to actually listen can be very difficult.
I am furiously shaking my head right now. Absolutely. There's no way. So
I thought when you started talking about your wife, I thought she injured her finger yanking the credit card out of your hand, but then I realized it was had to do with a tumor.
Yeah, it was, I mean, we were cleaning stuff before we went, because, you know, like as we were leaving, it was coming into winter. And so we wanted to make sure some stormwater drains were clear and that they have these big, heavy grates on them at our joint. And when she slid one back into place, she actually got it caught between the two grates and crushed the end of her finger. So weirdly, the thing they were worried about most was infection from the nail if it had broken the skin. So obviously under your fingernails, got heaps of gunk in there. So they operated the same day. They did a really good job. When she came back, though, I mean, and always the way when you see a doctor, she came back and the doctor looked at her finger and said, oh, yeah, that's healing pretty well. I probably should have put a pin in that, though. It's a bit late now, mate. Like, that was 5 weeks ago. Like, unless you want to re-break her finger and do it properly now. So she's going to have a bit of a wonky end of her finger forever. But now it's actually healed. So we've been climbing again and she's starting to be able to grip stuff properly with it again. So that's, what's that, like 3 months or so? So it shows how long it really takes to get over a small break like that.
Oh, okay. I understood that she injured it using a Jumar, but she has actually a proper injury that required surgery. She really trashed her finger.
Okay. She crushed the tip of her finger 5 days before we went. And because you got to put a brace on it and even the dressing to make sure it didn't get infected and stuff. So couldn't actually fit it under a glove. So we got to Kathmandu and went straight to Tamil and bought her a pair of like good quality mitts that she could actually brace her finger and then stick it in a mitt. So a whole bunch of stuff. And then obviously, you know, when you got your hand in a mitt, coming on and off a line is slower, right? Because it's difficult to unscrew things and like everything just slowed down because of that and because of the conditions. So yeah, we got to about 5,800 meters and it was just clear that while we could have made the top, the extra time it was going to add on, we were going to end up with like an 18-hour day. And we were thinking like, well, hang on, we've still to climb Island Peak in 6 days' time or something. Like it's not going to be possible. And so we should save our bullets now so that we can do that. And then by the time we came down, like her finger was so sore, I could just see from the look on her face that trying to climb again was going to be a bad idea. And she would have done it because she's super tough. My wife is, if you went into a bar and you looked for the smallest guy picking a fight with the biggest guy, that would be my wife. So she's super tough, will never back down from anything, but gets herself into trouble because of it.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah. So on the toughness note and the what I alluded to earlier, your wife sounds like she's completely no nonsense, and obviously you are too, Andrew. What are some of the nonsense fitness trends that you see bubbling up in the past couple of years? Let's say in the past 2 years or 3 years, yeah.
I mean, what are some of
the ones that really stick?
Fasting is a big one. So everyone thinks that it's a great way to lose weight. I mean, the reality is every diet works only because of one reason, and that's that there's a calorie deficit. There's an energy deficit, right? So your intake and your output are different, and it's that difference that creates the fat loss. And it doesn't matter whether you reduce the amount of time you eat for or whether you reduce the types of foods you eat, like a ketogenic diet or a vegan diet, for instance, remove entire macronutrients from you, or whole food groups, or you know, whatever it happens to be, but you reduce something, so it's a reductionist diet to me, and they all work the same way, is that by restricting some part of eating, you're going to end up losing weight. The problem is that when you're overweight, and overweight is really at about 15% body fat and up. So people can say, oh, well, normal is this much body fat or whatever. But the fact is our shape is a million years old and we're hunter-gatherers. And despite the easy access to food now, we are hunter-gatherers. And so anything you do that doesn't honor that hunter-gatherer shell is actually a negative. So being overweight as a hunter-gatherer didn't happen because food wasn't plentiful enough. So the actual number for being overweight is much, much lower than people think because of how common being overweight is. But when you're overweight, every time you enter a fast, so within the first 24 hours of entering that fast, your metabolism slows down. It's very different if you're lean. If you're lean and you're under 15%, when you enter that fast, your metabolism speeds up. So someone like me, so I walk around about 12 or 13% body fat most of the time. If I decided to do some fasting, I would get leaner. There's some other problems that come in the long term, but I would get leaner in the short term just from doing that, even eating the same amount of calories. Someone who's overweight, though, every time they enter that fast and that intermittent fasting, like 18-6 kind of protocol, you break that fast every single day. So you're going into this cycle over and over and over. And every single time you do, you slow your metabolism down more. You actually need to stay in that fasting state for more than 24 hours when you're overweight to create that same metabolic boost that a lean person does within the first 24 hours. So when people, and the kind of people who are predisposed to thinking that fasting is a great way to get somewhere are the kind of people who are trying to achieve something by nothing. So, you know, like without wanting to put any real effort into it, they're thinking this is going to be an easy way to do it, but they're just making it harder for themselves. Because every time you slow your metabolism down, it means that the next time you want to lose weight, you've actually got to restrict your calories even more and more. And then the psychology of dieting goes that my diet failed, and it doesn't matter what the diet was. My diet failed. It's because I'm weak. I didn't do it hard enough. I need something more extreme. And so then they go from 18-6, maybe they go to like 24 or something. And then next thing you know, they're doing whole weekend fast. And then it's a 24 intermittent fasting schedule on a ketogenic diet with full weekends of water only. And of course, no one's going to stick to that because it's too hard. And so you set yourself up for failure. But again, you don't recognize that you failed because you did something that was impossible. You failed because in your mind, you weren't tough enough. And you failed because it's impossible to stick to that diet, not for any other reason. But every time you fail, you decide you're going to make it harder and harder. And fasting is, when I speak to people, the number one problem that I see in overweight guys is that I have to stop them doing that. So I don't actually even work with clients anymore who fast. I refuse to because I can't get the result that I want from them. And same with veganism. I won't work with vegans anymore either. They need to eat some animal protein because they can't get the result that we're really chasing on a vegan diet. So fasting is the first one. I think cold water immersion is another one. All these people talking about like the huge benefits and blah, blah, blah. To me, there is only one benefit to cold water immersion or cold in general, as that people generally are pretty weak. So they live in a climate-controlled environment. They drive to work in their climate-controlled car. They're always comfortable, regardless of what the outside temperature is, because they put the heater or the air conditioning on. And they're never outside of that sort of optimal range for them as far as they're concerned. They sit in their comfy chair. They're driving their comfy car. There's no hardship in their life at all. And so you need to put some hardship in your life. We're actually hardwired for hardship. You know, the human being thrives on difficulty and challenge. That's actually the story of our progress as a species, is that we've thrived on challenge. We crossed the oceans on sticks using stars to navigate. We climbed mountains. We flew to the moon on what amounts to a rocket with a pocket calculator for navigation. Like, just the level of challenge that previous humans have gone through versus where people are now is so different. That cold water experience might actually open your mind up to a level of possibility that you hadn't thought was there. And so if you have a cold shower today, well, maybe you're okay with going on a cold hike tomorrow. And after you've been on that cold hike, then you think, well, hang on, maybe I could run a marathon in suboptimal conditions. Or, you know what I mean? Like, it just opens your brain to being able to do tougher stuff. But I think people are doing it for all these reasons that are at best foggy. There's no great concrete research to show anything that is going to make a huge difference to people. And when, doesn't matter the fad you're talking about, whether it's BCAAs, whether it's pre-workout, whether it's cold baths, fasting, all these different things, they're all a 1% thing. And the big things are always the same. The big things are always get the right amount of sleep, some base daily activity, eat the right amount of food. The training itself is actually almost unimportant, because if you get those first three things right, you'll see how little training you need to actually feel good and to be fit and healthy. If you want performance, that's a different story. But if you get sleep, activity, and the amount of food correct, everything else will be right. And people are focusing on this fasting or cold water stuff or whatever the other thing is, and at the same time, they're overeating substantially. They get less than 5,000 steps a day. You know, they're getting 5 hours of sleep a night. They're wondering why they're not getting anywhere. You're not set up to get anywhere. The performance side of stuff is the very tip of the pyramid. The supplements and all these other fad things that you've asked about, they are the tip of the pyramid. They represent at best 1% to 5% of what your potential is. But unless you've got the other 80% as the base in place, it's not going to make any difference. I would much rather have someone who's got 80% in place and does none of the other stuff than someone who's chased a bunch of 1% things and has managed to accumulate together 6 or 7% of their potential. Like, it's not even going to be a close contest.
So why do you think that people have such a hard time with the basic concept of just paying attention to how much they're eating? Like, you have a video about that one, and I wanted to share it, and it becomes a, I don't know if you get any blowback from talking about food and diet and our relationship with food, but it's so weird that you could say to somebody, you'll lose a ton of weight if you never eat meat again, or if you only eat meat, or if you only eat for 5 hours a day, or there's like a million different things that we can, you know, apparently do that people don't seem to be offended by. But people who've asked me how they should go about leaning out, and I say, like, well, how much are you eating? And they have no idea. And they like recoil in horror at the idea of having to count calories as though it's such this giant compromise. Like, imagine if I tried to sell you a car and it didn't have a fuel gauge in it, or if you just never looked at your online banking. I mean, it's insane to when you put it that way, right? Like, it sounds crazy. You pay you measure everything else, input and output, but you don't do it with your health. It's totally mystifying to me. Why do you think that people are so put out by that idea?
I couldn't agree more. And I say exactly that to people. I mean, if you can tell me how far you ran, at what pace, at what heart rate, cadence, or you can tell me how much weight you lifted and for how many reps, but you have no idea how much you ate yesterday, there's your problem. So if you're serious about the result, you have to be serious about all of the elements that go into it. And that's, I guess, as I've gotten older, you know, I started off with just being interested in the training, and then it was the training and the diet. Then it became like training and diet and lifestyle. And now I've realized that all of it is tied together by mindset. And I think when it comes to counting calories, as it's different, when I started, you know, like back in the Stone Ages, even before the internet, you would have to go to the chemist, and the chemist sold these little books that had all of, like, most common foods and the amount of calories in them per 100 grams. And you would have to go through and manually do the math for everything that people ate. And so the training diaries that I would sell my clients actually had a, like, one page was a workout and the other open page was diet for the day. And I would go through manually each week and add all their foods up, which obviously was very, very time consuming. And people seem to think that weighing your food and tracking it is going to take an enormous amount of time. I weigh everything I eat every day and have for more than 18 months straight as an experiment for myself. So I work with a diet coach because I like the accountability. And obviously for some of the stuff I'm doing, it's completely new territory for me. And this guy's a PhD both in psychology and nutrition. So he's tremendously experienced in anything you can throw a hat at in terms of diet and compliance to diet. And people look at this thing and they think it's going to be time consuming. It's going to be a huge hassle. And they blow it off because they think it's a hassle. But the side effect and the thing that people miss is that when you blow off a small hassle now, weighing my food, right? Which at best, and I'll use my breakfast this morning as an example. So I had 100 grams of broccoli, I had 100 grams of mushroom, and I had 180 grams of lean mince as my breakfast this morning. That took me total weighing time less than 30 seconds, right? But it's a hassle. That's 30 seconds I can't get back. But the other side of that is if I didn't do it, what I actually face is a big hassle every day of looking at myself in the mirror and feeling like I'm not at my best, of not being happy with what I see, of feeling like I let myself down. And people need to realize that you can either face the small hassle and deal with it at the time so that it doesn't become a big hassle that hassles you every single day, 24/7, until you start dealing with the small hassles. And I mean, I've got customers who've just started with me in the last 2 weeks. One guy lost 5 kilo in the first week. And he was still eating too much food because his instructions for the first week were just eat. I just want to see how much you're eating. And then we can start, you know, like making better recommendations in the second week. He still lost 5 kilo in the first week
simply by cutting out the junk food, which tells you how much food he was really eating to begin with. But he's already understood how important this is because he's seen the magic of it in week one. I've got another customer who's in the opposite boat. He can't figure out why he's not losing weight, but now he's started measuring his food. His protein intake is less than my 80-year-old 50-kilo mother eats every day. So he's eating about a third of the amount of protein he needs to eat for the day. And his total calories for the day are in the 900 to 1,000 calorie mark. He's nearly in the territory of a POW in World War II in terms of his total calorie intake per day. And he's wondering why his body's so stressed out it won't lose weight. So once you start dealing with that small hassle, you give up on that big hassle that is just bugging you long term. But people don't realize that those small hassles, it doesn't matter what it is, fold the laundry. If you've done the laundry, fold the laundry, put it away. Don't sit it on your couch for a week, letting it bug you for a week. When the dishwasher's finished, take the plates out, put them away. Deal with that small hassle now and not deal with a bigger hassle later on. And the diet stuff is exactly the same.
You know, you're talking about a hassle. You're talking about, I think people are going to see this as making sacrifices, sacrificing the time it takes to weigh your food if you're going to go that far, or sacrificing your time away from whatever. But I always say that these aren't sacrifices if you're living a fit, active life like the three of us are, and that we hope that our listeners are too. It's about making choices, and we are making these choices. I don't think we're really making sacrifices. I think we're making choices. And when Peter talks about people buying cars, let's say this, paying more attention. He mentioned cars, but people do far more research and care far more about their vehicle than they do about their own body. And that is something that, or about a new TV, they'll do more research and they'll know more about that than they knew about their own body. And I think that is, it's such an excellent point.
Yeah, well, it's all choices. And that's, you know, like people can call it whatever they want, whether they want to call it a stress, a hassle, a cost, a choice. But when I talk to customers about choices, the first rule is don't make a choice that makes your life worse. Like in most situations, you can make a choice that at least keeps your life no worse than it is now. But if you, and if we keep with the car analogies, if you get a flat tire, right? So let's say you ate a bad meal on Friday night, and bad only defined by the goals that you're chasing, whatever they happen to be, but you ate something that wasn't in line with your goals. Don't wake up Saturday morning and have another bad meal because in your head you go, oh, well, I screwed it up. I'll just start again Monday. That's like you're getting a flat tire and getting out of the car and slashing the other three. Don't do that. Make a choice that at least allows you to limp on as best you can. And the best choice Saturday morning would be just go back to your plan. Don't make it worse. And so it doesn't matter what the choice is, whether it's a dietary choice, a workout choice, a lifestyle choice, like what time you went to bed. Don't make your next choice worse. Make it at least so that your life is no worse than it was before the last bad choice, and just get back on track as soon as possible.
Yeah. It's completely normal to do that. We're all human and we will always slip up. And then you can't bin the whole thing because you made one screw up.
Yeah. But, and that's, you know, I feel like people, they think they're going to chase perfection, and that's obviously not possible. And usually I think perfectionism, or the people who say they're perfectionists, they're procrastinators, because we all recognize that perfection is impossible. And so stopping things or avoiding completing tasks because you will only do them if you believe they're going to be perfect is really just a way for you to put off doing them. So if you already understand that everything's a compromise and you're not going to be perfect and there are always going to be mistakes, it does give you the freedom to make a mistake and then start again, rather than think that, oh, I'm going to be in trouble with, I don't know, like who's the celestial diet governing body that is somehow looking over everyone's shoulders and judging them for all eternity. Like, that doesn't exist. If you made a mistake, that's cool. Just own it though and say, okay, well, Friday night I hung out with Bill and Ted. Those guys, I always drink and eat too much when I'm with them. Okay, so don't meet up with Bill and Ted on a Friday night. Maybe meet them for breakfast instead when you're less likely to overeat. You still get to hang out with them, but you've set yourself up in a way that you can be successful sticking to your goals and still maintain that relationship. You know, so don't make the same mistake and go back and hang out with Bill and Ted again on Friday night next week and shrug your shoulders and say, oh, damn, you know, it happened again. Don't let it happen again. You made a choice to go back and repeat that exact same mistake.
Andrew, totally. Like, that's, I give that advice to everybody all the time who seek it for me. And I give myself that advice all the time too, like, because I screw it up as well. But if you can just kind of look 2 to 4 days ahead all the time and kind of try and see the pitfalls, right? So you know that Bill and Ted are kind of bad news. They're good guys. You love them. Meet them for brunch, not for beers, right? Like you can usually know. And if you've got like some work travel coming up, plan, like, when are you going to work out? Look at the schedule, figure it out. If you leave it to chance, it's not going to happen, right? And you're just going to make mistake after mistake. So you just need to plan a little bit farther ahead. I think that's bang on.
Yeah. I always get, particularly with travel, travel is a big one. You know, the guys who travel for work, they're like, oh, well, I was traveling, so I had to have a McDonald's burger. Hey, mate, last time I went to a McDonald's, which does happen from time to time, they were serving salads. So it is possible to go to McDonald's and have a salad. You decided to have a burger. Or the guys who are at the airport, and they're like, oh, you know, because I was at the airport, so I had a couple of beers. I've been to an airport many times and have never drunk, and because I don't drink at all.
Yeah, it's not part of security clearance.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And so, like, you chose.
Yeah.
And so it's perfectly okay to do these things. And for, I can remember one of the guys I used to train, and he did travel a lot internationally. So lived in Denmark and would work like Sweden, Norway, like all around that area. So would be often in and out of airports. And he said for him, when he started being able to travel and not drink at the airport, the amount of different changes it made in his life, like everything instantly got better. And it's such a weird, like such a small thing. You think, well, how can 2 drinks before your plane change things? Yeah, but it was 2 drinks that he really didn't need to have like 4 days a week. It's a tremendous amount of difference in terms of how you sleep. And then because you're sleeping better, you relate to everybody else better the next day. So your communication is better, your relationships are better. You feel more likely to train, you have more energy. There's all these different things that came from it. But all it was realizing that he could go through an airport, wait for a plane, and not have to drink. And such a small thing, but it made such a massive change overall to his life.
So, Andrew, what, give us, we're coming up on an hour here, Shirley, although I could go on a lot, or we could go on a lot longer. I love this. I really enjoy this. First thing I want to say, if anybody in Melbourne has stumbles upon Andrew in a McDonald's, I want a photo or a video sent to me immediately. And then, what is your typical day like for working out? What do you tell me what Andrew Reed did this? Well, I guess it's morning there, but what'd you do yesterday morning? What'd your day look like?
Yeah, so I basically have, we'll call it 3 days, and they get, and the third day is just the Saturday where you put in a typical kind of long session. During the week, the 2 days, there's a strength day and there's a cardio day. So yesterday was Monday for me. I lifted weights in the morning and we indoor climbed in the afternoon. On today, I do like a kettlebell circuit straight into about 30 minutes of steady state rowing this morning. And then this afternoon, we'll drag sleds for an hour around the park. And that's our typical cardio day at the moment. This week, though, we'll start to get a little bit longer because from December, so we go to Ama de Blam right at the start of April. So we've got 4 months. So we need to start making some of these sessions a little bit longer and adding in a little bit of extra cardiovascular stuff. And that's the trickiest part of the schedule is actually managing stuff with my wife because of her job. You know, there are days where they do nothing all day because no one has an emergency. And there are other days where she can't fit in a training session at all. So that's actually the trickiest part of managing training. But I'm typically training twice a day. On Saturdays at the moment, we are riding a bike for 3 hours, and that's really just to give us a break from walking with a pack on. We'll reintroduce the pack again this weekend, and we'll still do a recovery ride on Sunday, though, for a couple of hours in the morning. So, as I said, I view mountaineering as kind of a triathlon with 3 separate things that need to be trained. So there's a strength and conditioning side, there's the base fitness side, and then there's the technical climbing skills. So we're trying to cover those as best we can. And part of our concern for Ama de Blam is, and I would think for someone who's more experienced, that yellow tower section looks tricky, but probably isn't for someone who's experienced. But for us, thinking about climbing with a pack and in big boots and stuff like that is probably going to be a little bit tricky. So that's one of the reasons why we're focusing on climbing at the moment, is to build skill for that so we can make that as easy as possible.
What about core? Are you doing lots of core stuff?
Sure, that goes in strength sessions. Yeah. And so my basic format for people, I run this thing called the 28-day challenge. And it's from this article I wrote years ago now called 874321. And it's 8 hours of sleep a night, 7 walks a week, because again, we're designed as hunter gatherers and really designed for far more activity than we use now. So walking is separate to workouts. 4 is 4 good meals a day, simply because that you have a breakfast, lunch, dinner, and then probably a pre or post workout snack of some kind as well. And that fits in reasonably well with most people's work lives. When you start telling people to eat like 5 or 6 times a day, for instance, can be very tricky for a lot of people to actually find that time in a busy work day to eat that much. But 4 good meals a day, 3 cardiovascular sessions a week, and you want to do twice as much recovery as you do strength work. So anything that's super stressful in your body, so that would be very anaerobic fitness work. So if you're doing VO2 max, if you're doing track intervals, something like that, you would need the same recovery from that as you do from a strength session. So recovery can be the walking, because gentle cardiovascular stuff has got a really soothing effect on the nervous system. It can be zone 2 or lower base cardiovascular stuff. It can be yoga, can be foam rolling, can be massage. There are a bunch of different formats that recovery stuff can take. But if you follow that, and particularly with the 8 hours sleep and the gentle cardio stuff, you can fit a tremendous amount of training in as a, I'm going to say, an older athlete. You know, I can still train. I'm 52. I can train up to 25 hours a week with no problem, provided I make sure I'm in bed by 8 to 8:30 every night. I get up at 5, mm-hmm. so I know I'm getting 8 to 9 hours sleep every night. You know, but those are the bases. Is that the core stuff and the walking, that's all part of like the overall plan. So that's just stuff that's getting hit without me having to, sorry, in my head to mention it specifically, but that's all definitely in there.
What's the 2 and the 1? Did I miss that?
2 was twice as much recovery work as actual work.
Okay.
And the 1 I can't even remember because I don't actually use that anymore. I actually just teach it as 8-7-4-3 now. So it's the,
okay,
the 8 hours sleep, 7 walks, 4 good meals, 3 cardio sessions a week. And the cardio in the fitness industry, everyone wants to push strength as being this dominant quality. The last time I checked the leading causes of death, it wasn't because people had a weak bench press or a weak deadlift. The leading cause of death is heart attacks. And so the cardiovascular mm-hmm. stuff, along with diet and controlling your weight, that's the number one way you can control heart health. So you know, that has to be a priority over the strength stuff, just from a longevity point of view. We definitely need the strength, but it shouldn't be at the expense of making sure you have a healthy heart, because that's the most important muscle in the body.
Which is excellent. Yeah, I wrote that down. That's good. And we'll provide a link. If you could email me the link to that article or to that program, and I can we can direct people to your website, Andrew.
Sure. I usually only run 1 or 2 a year. We're obviously coming up to the time of year when I would run it. So there'll be one at the start of January.
Well, listen, this has been excellent. You're not nearly as cranky as people make you out to be. I got to say that. And then, you know, one thing I've taken away from this is one thing that Peter and I preach all the time on our podcast is that discomfort's okay. And it's actually required. And I heard a good quote the other day that aging is the aggressive pursuit of comfort. And I think that aggressive pursuit of comfort is what's killing us. And everything in our life is automated and everything is designed to be comfortable. So this was a real good eye-opener, a dose of reality, like I said in my post the other day. And we really appreciate you being on the podcast, Andrew. We want to have you on again after you get back from Nepal.
Definitely. Yeah, well, fingers crossed we don't break anything before we go this time. It'll be interesting. So the company we use in Nepal, the 2 bosses and their head guy who's done 5 Everest summits, so fairly experienced, they got up Amma Deblam in April when we going. And then they said, though, when they came down, no one else got up that season. Like, the weather just wasn't good enough. And so, fingers crossed, right? Like, it's one of those elements you never know about.
Timing's everything.
Yeah, but thank you, guys.
No,
it's been awesome.
No one to push, not, yeah. Thank you. Absolute pleasure. We'll be following along from Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and getting some motivation from Melbourne, so we appreciate it. Thanks, Ed.
Yeah, thank you. And I say to people all the time, like, the Himalayas are a content goldmine because you can't beat the backdrop, right? Like, instant views just because of what's in the background.
Totally.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have you back. We want to hear all about it. Thank you. Be well.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you again, everybody, for tuning into the podcast and giving it a listen. We really appreciate you doing that. It means a lot to us. If you can shoot us a note at adventureaudiopodcast@gmail.com, that is how you can enter the 4i contest. So if you want to try and win a power meter from 4i Technologies or a heart rate monitor, you'll be entered to win. Shoot us a note and tell us where Andrew was born. That's how you can enter. And a reminder to go back to the previous three episodes, because we did this for four in total. So you can enter four times if you shoot us the answer to those clues as well. They're in the episodes. They're pretty easy to find. If you just give it a listen, you can find that out and shoot us a note and enter. And the best way for you to support the podcast is simply by word of mouth. So letting people know about it, if you've liked what you've heard here, or we are creating something that you have some friends or family that might be interested in, we really appreciate that. Give us a share or a follow on social media, or a positive rating or review on whatever podcast platform you're finding us. And give Andrew Reed a follow. So again, his last name is spelled R-E-A-D. It's Reed PT on Instagram. He's a badass. Give him a follow. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back soon.